This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy is with us to bring us up to date on what's happening in the community these days. And first off, thanks for joining us on the program today, sir.
Hey, great to be on, Chris. How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. I know that that Valparaiso, along with many other communities across Indiana and Northwest Indiana, are getting ready to take in the funds that is coming from the American Rescue Plan is coming out of Washington and being handed out to states across the nation. And I know that you and your members of the city council are getting together. And in fact, there's an ordinance that's coming up, being reviewed up for first reading and now for further reading at the future city council meetings as to what is coming in from the state and from the nation. What plans does the city of Valparaiso have to be able to use the federal funds that are going to be available and the city council gets to administer?
Sure. The indications we've received from the federal government through Congressman Mervan's office is that Valparaiso is set to receive about $7 million in two tranches this year and next year, so mm-hmm. probably half this year and half next year. We have not received any of those funds yet, and we're still defining how the funds can be used according to all the rules and regulations coming out of Indianapolis and really Washington, D.C. And we'll be developing a plan now so that we can use the funds effectively on Valpo priorities, but it's a little premature to outline a plan right now.
Yeah, that's part of the plan that you're going through now is looking at what you have to work with in general, and I'm sure priorities are going to be in line. Have you had a chance to talk with city council members about what you'd like to be able to use the money for?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, but it's just unclear what the rules are. So once we have a good understanding of what exactly, it seems that the guidance we're getting right now is very broad. But we want to make sure that we're staying within the rules and regulations of all that before we come out with a plan. So we'll be engaging the council short order.
Yeah, I guess that what is up, I guess, within the ordinance that's already on the agenda for city council is, I guess, you have to have, obviously, a fund to be able to establish where the money is going to go. And you haven't had an opportunity at least to talk not only with the council, but with residents as to, within the guidelines, what you'd like to use the money for?
Yeah, so the first thing the council had to do is create a fund so that when we receive the money, we can put that those dollars into the appropriate fund. And ultimately, we have to present, the city administration has to present a plan for those funds to the council, which then they will approve and appropriate. And again, we're in the very beginning phases. I've talked to a lot of people about ideas and thoughts, and there's a wide variety of ideas floating around, a lot of good ones, a lot of bad ones. My goal, you know, as mayor, is I look back when Mayor Costas received major moves money from the state of Indiana. It was sort of a windfall we hadn't planned on. And, you know, I remember those funds were used for really transformative projects in our community that will last many multiple generations. So that's about all I can tell you right now, that the mindset that I have for those dollars. I want to do the same thing, mm-hmm. be wise with them, use them very wisely, make wise investments with them, and protect every dollar that we can. And really, the goal is that it's going to be, you know, whatever we invest in will be around for multiple generations for our community to enjoy.
Going back to the major moves money that you had an opportunity as a member of the staff at the city of Valparaiso to work with, what did you were able to do with the funds back then? Obviously, there will probably be similar guidelines if you haven't gotten official word on yet what at least the latest money is when the American Rescue Plan is going to dole out. What did you have a chance to do back then with the major moves money?
Well, you know, Chris, a big chunk of the major moves money was allocated towards our Central Park Plaza in downtown Valpo, which is our most popular park in the city. We have 19 parks. It's the most popular park in Valparaiso. And that was obviously a really wise investment for the city. And a lot of other, there were some stormwater projects. There, I think some pathways, things that are they're still around today that you can point at and say, that was Major Moves money, you know, we invested in, and we can still enjoy it. And but a big chunk of the Major Moves money that the city received went into investing in Central Park Plaza, the acquisition, the construction. It was a very expensive endeavor, but we did it, and we didn't hand a bill to the next generation. It was paid for, didn't borrow any money, and was done, done very prudently on a financial matter.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy about what's happening in the city these days. We have mentioned that the city council and the administration will be getting to work with allocations from the American Rescue Plan. That's in the works right now. What are some of the other projects that are underway, certainly with road projects and the like, that is happening in the city of Valparaiso these days?
Yeah, you know, we have just we've been so blessed with the progress in paving in Valparaiso. Again, you know, we're looking forward to another productive year in roadway projects. Last year, in the first year of my new administration, even during the pandemic, we were able to pave a record number of miles, about 12 miles. This year, we're off again on the right foot. We won a $1 million community crossing grant from NDOT. This grant will help us improve roads very well traveled in Valparaiso, including big sections of Morgan, Calumet, and Roosevelt Road. Right now, there are several roadway projects underway in the city, an NDOT project on the 49 overpass at Vail Park Road.
Mm-hmm.
This is routine maintenance work, but it will extend the life of the roadway. We're told it will finish early and reopen on Monday, May 24th, barring any major weather delays. Also have a project on Silhavy Road, which includes new asphalt, curbs, gutters. It will be widened somewhat at the new signal, plus a lot of underground work to improve stormwater issues. This project has experienced some supply delays due to COVID and the issues in Texas that have caused a shortage of plastic pipe, but we're still optimistic it will be completed and fully reopened this year. And another roadway project that's a real success story is work we're doing over on Eisenhower. This project was initiated by neighbors. They approached the city with really a problem that had been neglected for many years, and it was just it was time to tackle it. So we submitted that for a grant, which happened, and then we added some city funds to it. So neighbors are looking forward to paving, curbs, new sidewalks where none existed before, plus underground utility improvements. My goal is to be over on Eisenhower Avenue for trick-or-treat night, because those folks in that neighborhood have not had sidewalks, and so they're really excited about that. So those are some of the highlights in paving. We're looking forward to another busy paving year in Valpo.
I know that that your administration has been working with other groups in Valparaiso to address the issue of affordable housing. It's an issue that every community really has, but it's been, I know, one big project that has been going on for decades, it seems, with administrations, with the Costas administration before you, and now you're getting to deal with it. What's the latest that you're bringing up here with your staff on the issue of affordable housing?
Yeah, we recently released a comprehensive residential market study that shares current inventories and emerging priorities in housing. We've shared this with the community to many stakeholders throughout, including developers and residents and folks in the affordable housing sector, and we will continue to weigh projects based on this data. The city was decided to partner with the Uptown partners to do a workforce housing project at the old Uptown apartments. With the closure of the law school, we have two empty buildings, and the plan was to put about 112 workforce housing units there. That's delayed a little bit. There's a lawsuit with the university that we're working through, but we're hopeful we can work that out and get that project going as well. So Yeah, it's something that is it affects every community, and in Valparaiso, we're tackling it best we can. And the most important thing that we're trying to do is do what we've always done in Valpo, and that's have a balanced housing approach. And we can't get too out of whack in one way or the other. We can't have too much high end or too much low end. It's got to be a blend, and that's, I think, one of the strengths of our community is you can go from very affordable up to some really what I would consider extremely unaffordable houses in Valparaiso, and we've got everything in between. And to me, that's one of our strengths, is we've got something for everybody, and we're really proud of that. So we're going to continue to focus on having a balanced housing approach to our city.
One of the other areas I know that you have worked in, certainly in the past because you've been economic development director in the city of Valparaiso, is bringing new businesses to the city. There are projects that are underway right now. Of course, the expansion and the renovation in the old ANCO site that is not only going along with expanding business, but the city transit system. What's the latest in getting the Journeyman Brewery up and running and getting that business opened up soon?
Sure. That's a major project and a transformative project for the city, and we've been working with the potential developers of that, obviously Journeyman Distillery, now for months to tackle all the issues, and I think we're getting really, really close to coming to an agreement on how that whole program will work in terms of the city and what we're going to provide and what the private sector will provide. So we're close, and I can tell you it's going to be an amazing project. We toured their facility in Three Oaks, and it's really a destination, and I think it's a game changer for the city of Valparaiso. So I think we're getting close. We're tackling a lot of different issues. As you know, that's a 70,000 square foot, really, very old building with a lot of issues, and the substantial investment, and so we've got a lot of things to work through, but we're getting close. And we've also, as you know, I think we talked maybe last month about, if it was announced or not yet, but Amazon's new delivery station in Valparaiso, that's opening. We're excited about that. Also, St. Mary Medical Center is working on a third floor expansion of their Valparaiso campus, which we're really excited about. And we also recently announced a plan to break ground. Sold some property to Ecos Window and Wall, a state-of-the-art factory to manufacture glass curtain walls in Valparaiso. And hopefully that announcement will be soon groundbreaking. So together, these businesses alone represent more than $40 million in investment, plus more than 400 new jobs. That doesn't include the Journeyman investment. We're not quite sure exactly what that investment's going to be, but it's going to be upwards of $30 million in private and $15 million in public. So there's some big projects going on we're excited about, and we want to keep the pedal to the metal.
Mm-hmm. I know this is the only big problem I know is trying to deal with these projects and the developers having to deal with their own individual issues with the pandemic still at large. And it's part of the things you have to fit in together as a mayor and the administration has to deal with, right?
Absolutely. And we're here to support our businesses. They did a great job during the pandemic. And we really value the Valpo businesses, and we saw how hard they worked. And we were actually one of the few communities to apply for and win grant funds to help qualifying businesses retain jobs. We're calling this grant the Valpo Invest in Business, or VIB grant. We expect to be able to distribute up to about $10,000 per qualifying business. We're still getting the guidelines from the Indiana Office of Community and Rural Affairs, or OCRA, who awarded the grant to the city. We invite businesses to sign up for the information as we receive it. Businesses can learn more on our website at valpo.us by visiting the economic development page, again, valpo.us. So check that out. We're really excited about that grant. We received $250,000 from OCRA. So we're excited about that. We want to get those dollars in the hands of these businesses that, that qualify.
Finally, Mayor Murphy, I know that there's been some good news lately that's come out with trying to help neighbors, neighbors trying to help neighbors in getting their homes renovated. Many people have had problems trying to get caught up with the repairs at their house, and city members and as well as neighbors have been able to get together and get their neighbors dealing with these issues, taken care of. The home care program in particular is one big program that's gotten some attention lately, I understand.
Yeah, you know, Home Team Valpo has just been it's been a great initiative. It's something that, that I advanced during my campaign, and we acted on it in my first month, even during the pandemic. I saw it as a priority, and we were pleased to make it happen. Today, Home Team Valpo is a nonprofit supported by the city of Valparaiso in priority, manpower, and funding, designed to, as you said, help Valpo homeowners make their homes safer, more accessible, more efficient, and more comfortable. And this helps neighborhoods, one house at a time. On Saturday, last Saturday, city staff joined community volunteers in a spring cleanup effort. We helped 7 homeowners in our parks properties. We had 70 volunteers from Valpo High School. They were football players in the effort, plus dozens of community volunteers. We cleaned yards, we painted, we landscaped, took down some trees. The football players picked up 30,000 golf balls at Creekside that were that we couldn't pick up with our machinery. We planted 8 trees. We spread about a half a ton of stone. It was a great day, and we made a big difference out at Creekside and for homeowners and neighborhoods. And this event followed others that we've helped, dozens of homeowners and united hundreds of volunteers for Home Team Valpo this past year. We're really happy with bringing people together and seeing all ages benefit. We've had many Valpo students help, and that's been really great to see, including students from Vail School. And I mentioned the football team and the soccer teams helped on Saturday. So if folks want to learn more about how they can get involved in Home Team Valpo, they have a website. It's just HomeTeamValpo.org. Check it out and get involved.
Well, Mayor Murphy, thank you for spending time with us here on Originally Speaking to talk about what's been happening in the city of Valpo and all the other projects as well, too. And I hope to have a chance to get you back on again to talk soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Matt Murphy is the mayor of Valparaiso, and you're listening to Originally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The organization, which is called Community Advocates for Northern Indiana, or CANI, has come up with a strategic plan to be able to raise awareness about the COVID-19 vaccination in communities of color. And we have with us the executive director of the organization, Tracy Lewis, with us to give us more. Tracy, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Will you take a moment and explain for folks that are not familiar with your organization what the CANI is all about, and in particular with this very new and exciting initiative that is in place thanks to the help of the state and other agencies to help fight the spread of COVID-19?
Absolutely. So Community Advocates of Northern Indiana, CANI for short, has a tagline, "Can I help?" Because we're out in the community asking where and how we can help. Our mission is to eliminate health disparities in the region, and so we do just that through a number of different projects. The one we're most excited about right now is Operation Educate, Engage, and Register, just to help to eliminate the spread and get us all back to normal by getting COVID-19 vaccinations in the arms of community members.
I know in particular that you're taking advantage of the mass vaccination pop-up clinic that's already been set up in Gary there at Roosevelt Park there on West 25th Avenue. And what are you hoping that OEER, I know is for short the operation is being called, what are you hoping to be able to accomplish with your help with that?
Well, what we're absolutely excited about doing is to accomplish, of course, eliminating health disparities. Right now, there are disparate numbers, and not as many people in communities of color are getting the vaccination. And so we're just hoping to educate and dispel myths about it in the hopes of getting those shots in the arms.
I know that there are a number of street teams that are out there. Will you tell us about the organization of that and how they are helping getting the word out, getting people to get over to Roosevelt Park to get the vaccinations?
Yes. So with the street teams, We are doing a hard target intensive outreach, knocking on doors, going there to different grocery stores, convenience stores, apartment complexes, actually taking the information and education door to door, and encouraging folks to get the shot. And if they're so willing, our street teams will register people right there on the spot.
Oh, good. How successful have getting word back from them as to how they're doing and getting people signed up to get the shot?
Well, we are just seeing some zip code information, and so we're experiencing some success. We'll probably end up being at the end of the program before we can definitively say just exactly how much, but the numbers are rising in each zip code that we've been in, and we like to think that has a large part to do with what we're out there working at.
You mentioned here just a moment ago about the work that the street teams are doing to get the word out, to get people signed up to be vaccinated. I know that you started in some key neighborhoods, and the Horace Mann neighborhood in particular. Will you tell us a little bit about how the door-to-door campaign got started there and working on to more neighborhoods in Gary?
Yes. So what we did there in Horace Mann, everyone just started there on 5th and Taft, and we worked our way heading east. Making our way, we probably got to Grant Street from Taft, 5th and Taft to 8th and Taft, all the way over to 5th and 8th of Grant Street. And then the other thing we're doing today, we're positioning and going outside of Roosevelt, so 21st Avenue to 15th Avenue in each direction, knocking on doors. We've got some new door hangers that talk about the work that we're doing and information, but also offers incentives.
That's great.
And so we've got some great incentives that we're offering as well.
Which other neighborhoods in Gary are you aiming for or the street team is working on right now?
So these are data-driven approaches, and we're working on 46402 and 46407 now. Because the numbers are seeming to lag there. And each week, we try and make sure that we let that the data drive us on the plan that we're making about where to go.
That's great. What are you finding in the research, and as well as what the door-to-door teams are reporting back to you, are for people that are probably the most at risk for coming down with COVID-19? Are there a lot of elderly, a lot of homebounds that don't have access to knowing about the vaccination site in particular here in Gary? And you're trying to kind of fill in the gaps, as you say, to be able to let them know if they haven't known already, if they haven't gotten the word out already, that they should get the vaccine right away.
Absolutely, Chris. We are. We haven't found that the numbers are extremely high with the homebound Hoosiers. We've been, prior to this effort, working on a homebound Hoosiers effort, and I'd like to believe that we've been effective in that. The calls have slowed down quite a bit, and so it looks like that's a group that's actually receiving the vaccinations when they request them.
Yeah.
And I have to say, in addition to the work that we're doing, we connect with Dr. Janet Seabrook, who's also doing it. I understand Dr. Walker Shop, the Gary Health Department, they're also addressing and reaching out to homebound Hoosiers. So I believe now that's not an area where we have folks who are wanting to have the shot and not getting it.
That's great. That's great to hear. Are you finding that all these efforts together, along with the help that you're getting from the Gary City Health Department and the State Department of Health, are getting more people told about the fact that, of course, all the publicity that's out there? We've been doing our share of getting notices out to let people know that the mass vaccination site there at Roosevelt Park is still open. It's going to be open for several more weeks to get people vaccinated, to get them out there. Is this all helping in the overall cause to let people know that they need to get the shot, they need to get vaccinated right away, and the more people vaccinated, the quicker the pandemic can abate?
That's so true. And you're right, all of these efforts are helping. I have to also include Community Health Net with Dr. Janet Seabrook. Mm-hmm. They're doing quite a bit as well. But you're right, there's information everywhere. We can't thank you and Lakeshore enough for your help in getting that information out. What we're finding with our street teams is people know about where to go, and so access isn't an issue, but making the decision to get the shot, overcoming some of the longstanding trust issues, and there are a lot of myths out there. That's where we really feel like we're being able to be effective, and there's an opportunity to change some minds there once we share the truth about the vaccination.
Now, Tracy, is there a place online or anywhere else that people can get more information, certainly about what CanEye is doing in this particular case and trying to get the word out about the vaccination sites, or any other information that you are getting out about the other programs you're working on?
Absolutely. So we have our website is canihelp.org.in. We also have a Facebook page, Community Advocates of NI, on Facebook there. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram as well. All of those will be referenced at the website if folks want to contact us that way. And just for general information about the shot and to dispel any myths or anything, Indiana State Department of Health, ourshot.in.gov is a great one to go to as well.
Tracy Lewis is Executive Director for the Community Advocates from Northern Indiana, which is CanEye for short. Thank you for being with us and bringing us up to date on how the teams are doing out there, talking to people in Gary, getting the neighborhoods galvanized and get them over to the mass vaccination site, the pop-up clinic at Roosevelt Park on West 25th Avenue. Thank you for being with us today.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
On this Thursday, we are following through with more on our topic of police and policing with a man who knows best about police departments and about law enforcement and about criminal justice. We're talking about Brian Vukadinovich. He is a Northwest Indiana native. He's an educator. He's also the author of a book which is out called Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case. It's published by Page Publishing. And it goes into great detail about certain topics of Brian's life that we are going to cover today, in particular dealing with police and with criminal justice and the like. And first, Brian, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hi, Chris. Good to be back.
Well, the book, Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case, goes into great detail about a number of topics, but most of them are focused around law enforcement in Indiana and the legal system. And going through the book, I took a look and noticed in more detail in one chapter, you've had a number of encounters with the Valparaiso Police Department, and in particular, a second encounter that you note in the book that the arresting officer had a history of filing false reports after it had been substantiated that you were, in fact, beaten and falsely arrested. And since you're familiar with assaults like these, as well as false reports that can certainly potentially ruin you professionally as well as personally, first, what are your thoughts about the recent climate of relations between police and civilians?
Well, unfortunately, the climate is very negative all across the country. What people are just now starting to realize, largely with, in light of the recent trial with Derek Chauvin, where he had murdered George Floyd by pressing his knee into his neck, and they had the recent trial here, a lot of people are now seeing and hearing about things that I experienced that I've known about for a long time. Mm-hmm. And first of all, let me say that even though I've had my share of experiences, negative experiences with police, there are a lot of very good police, and the majority are probably good people, good police officers. But there is a major problem with police corruption that's going on across the country. I've known about it for a long time. Had it not been for the coming of the cell phone era, we wouldn't know about the things that we're just now starting to see. When I was going through things, my situation started out back in 1981. I was at in a bank. It was a Saturday morning. I was with my mom. We were in a bank in Valparaiso, the First National Bank, and walked into the bank. And the next thing I knew was I had the police had arrived and pressed me against the wall, and beat me up pretty good inside the bank there, Valpo. And then what happened was the bank people called the Valparaiso police. There had been something going on out in the parking lot. I don't know what it was, but they came, and it was a case of mistaken identity. And then by the time they realized that they had the wrong person, they had already beaten me up pretty good. And the bank people were trying to tell them that they had the wrong person. And rather than just admitting that they made a mistake and apologizing, they went ahead and hit me with a bogus charge so they could take me in and make it look as though that they were okay with what they did. So to make a long story short, we went to court. Judge Billings was the judge in Valparaiso there, and he found me not guilty, and he chastised the police for what they did. And then my life just became a nightmare after that. I couldn't go to the store without getting arrested, falsely arrested. I had to hire a lawyer and pay money for that, for the defense and so forth. So then I filed a lawsuit against them and was awarded an out-of-court settlement. And then the very same officer again, the main officer that was behind this whole thing, did the same thing to me again. This time it was at the Wise Way store out on 30, saw me and threw me on top of the police car, worked me over pretty good, handcuffed me, put me in the back seat of the car, my hands cuffed behind my back, and a German Shepherd police dog growling at me. Now, back then, there were no cell phones. If people would have, you know, there were a lot of people that were watching what was going on, but nobody able to record. Now, back in those days, they would have recorded that, and the people would have seen what was happening, and I could have had that as evidence because the police denied it. Fortunately for me, there was an employee at Wise Way that saw what happened, and so we were able to track her down later on, and she came in and gave a statement, and then the judge ended up throwing the case out, the charges against me, the bogus charges. Again, they took me to jail, booked me, and hit me with a bogus charge, and then I would have to go through all that hell again, and again had to hire a lawyer, and then again file a lawsuit, received an out-of-court settlement, and I just couldn't go to the grocery store after that. It happened 10 times, mm-hmm. and it got really bad. It got to the point where I had a target on my back, and then the next thing I know is, you know, I'm going down the road, I'm on Roosevelt Road, going to work, and Valparaiso police stopping me. One arrest was for no headlights on. It was 4:27 p.m. It was in October of '86, and again, surrounded by police cars. As soon as they would hear my name on the radio, and then they would arrest me, work me over pretty good, take me to the jail, book me, and then I would have to go through all of the court proceedings again, and then the judge would throw the charges out, and we would end up in court again, and the same officer again on Roosevelt Road. See, they knew where I was a teacher, and they had my routine down where I went to work every day and what time I left home and what time I came home from work and so forth. And then the same officer again a couple of weeks later saw me on Roosevelt Road, stopped me, and I went ahead and just went home. I told him I'm tired of all the nonsense, and I went home, and then the police cars, there were three or four of them, were already there. He had already radioed them, and then they worked me over pretty good in my yard, in front of my mom, my brother, my neighbors, and ironically, as I watched the trial with Derek Chauvin here a couple of weeks ago,
yeah,
they were testifying about how he had pressed his knee into his neck, and then ironically in my book, it was on page 66-68, I talked about how this officer, his name was Ronald Kermis, they handcuffed me behind my back, put me in the back of the police car, and he had his knee pressed into my back all the way to the police station, and I couldn't breathe. I thought I was going to die. It was like when I was watching the trial, it was like deja vu. And I had written about this in the book from years ago that it had happened to me, the exact same thing. I thought I was going to die. That's exactly what I even wrote in a book. This is how they do things.
We're talking with Brian Vukadinovich, who's from Northwest Indiana. According to many, he's also considered to be the foremost expert in the country concerning pro se litigation. That's the ability to represent oneself in court. Talked about the topic many times, different forums, different interviews and the like. He's the author of a book which is entitled Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case. You mentioned about the numerous times that you've been arrested by police here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in Porter County. Would you tell us a little bit about the one incident that you encountered with the Porter County Sheriff's Department and what that was all about?
Yes, I was coming home from work. I was a basketball coach in Michigan City, an assistant basketball coach at Michigan City Rogers, and we had a basketball game that night. And I was on my way home. The basketball, usually the games end somewhere at about around 9 o'clock or so, somewhere in there. And I stopped at a teacher's house. There was a little get-together after the game. So I stopped at a teacher's house after the game, stayed for about 15 or 20 minutes, and I went back, and then I went home. And it was about 11 o'clock or so, somewhere in that time period. And then I got stopped by the Porter County Sheriff's Department officer, and he started in on me about, oh, Vukadinovich, and this and that, and they always like to play games with my name, and excuse my language here, but a lot of times they would say Vukadinovich, like that, just very negative with my name and so forth. And then he would bring up, you're my friend Buddy Collins's friend. That type of thing. Buddy Collins was the Valparaiso officer that started this whole thing. And, and I just wanted to go home. I was tired. I've been teaching all day. We had the basketball game at night, and I just wanted to go home. So then he broke my jaw. He struck me in the car, broke my jaw, took me to the station, arrested me, and handcuffed me the whole bit. And then when we got to the jail, my jaw, and he cracked my ribs, fractured my ribs. And when I got to the jail, I asked him to take me to get some medical attention, and they refused to do it, and they wouldn't let me make a telephone call. Nobody knew I was in jail, and I was really hurting. I had a broken jaw, broken ribs, and then so I had to stay in there overnight. They booked me. They charged me with a bogus DUI charge. And so the next day, they finally let me make a phone call. So I called my brother, and he came and got me out of jail, took me to the hospital at Porter Memorial, and then they did a surgery on my jaw and wired my jaw shut for 2 months. It was very painful. And then eventually, I mean, I had to be off work for 2 months with a broken jaw. It was a very hard thing to have to deal with. And then eventually we went to trial. We had a jury trial, and they kept prolonging the case and so forth. And I had all these charges pending against me that I was fighting and battling. And then we ended up going into the trial, and I was found not guilty of the charge. And it just, he happened to be, he was a really good-sized guy, and had a really big reputation for, he was an undercover officer. He was always involved in a lot of drug deals in Porter County as an undercover guy officer and so forth. Mm-hmm. It was just a bad situation, but the jury found me to be not guilty. And then the sad thing was, after the trial, we had there was another civil lawsuit with it, and then we took the sheriff's deposition. His name was Tim McCarthy. He was a sheriff at the time, and he testified on his deposition that he knew that they were going to lose that case because there wasn't the evidence that I was under the influence. The sheriff testified that he knew they were going to lose the case, and they still went ahead and prosecuted me anyway. And that courtroom was packed. It was a who's who of Porter County. Everybody was there. The politicians were there. the main prosecutor. It was just, it was a big circus act. You know, they thought, well, you know, we're going to finally be able to get him, and it didn't work out for him. So I just kept, you know, I kept defending myself, and all at a risk of my career. You know, it cost me a lot of money to have to defend the cases, and then I was teaching in Michigan City, and the Porter County Sheriff's officers went to my school, talked to my principals there, and you know, as soon as people see the police come in, naturally everybody wants to know what's going on, what happened, and then you end up looking like a big troublemaker. Just because of the fact that, you know, they make these arrests like they do, and that's part of their game plan for sure. And it's unfortunate. But everybody can now see what I've known for a long time. It's a big problem in the country.
Let me ask you, Brian, about the new state law as a result of a legislation that got passed by the General Assembly this past session here, dealing with some of the issues of police reform, as it's always commonly known, and some of the efforts to try to deal with officers that have been known to have left one police department and got a job at another, and a lot of times the disciplinary file does not follow along with them. Do you think that maybe there should be some sort of national register to be able to track police misconduct?
Absolutely. First of all, let me say this before I answer your question. When I was going through all of these things, I was able to get a lot of discovery in court, and there was a ton of information regarding the Valparaiso, because they were defendants in the case. I was able to discover tons of information where Valparaiso police were brutalizing people, and I also obtained copies of confidential informants' statements that were made where the Valparaiso police were planting drugs on people just so they could set them up. I mean, I still have those reports. So there's a lot of dirty police out there that are doing these things, and the municipalities that hire them, they know this, and they protect them, and they pay for lawyers for them and so forth. And yes, to answer your question, yes, there should be a national registry. There should be, just like you know, when a person gets arrested, they put his name in the paper, they put the charges in the paper. You know, later on, if he's found innocent, it doesn't matter. People have already seen what happened. So in all fairness, why is it then when there's dirty police out there doing things to people that are not justified, people should be aware of that? Just like a sexual predator that's been found guilty of things with kids, they put them on a registry. They can't go anywhere without having their name. They have to be registered. The same thing should have to take place with these police officers as well.
Let me ask you, related to this, do you think, in fact, you mentioned at the outset of our conversation about the fact that, you know, the situations that you have gone through during your life may not necessarily pertain to some people today, but there are still issues. We know that certainly it's followed through in other instances here with cases that have happened in Minneapolis and other states. Do you generally think that things have gotten better here in Northwest Indiana in law enforcement and criminal justice from the time that you ended up being arrested so many times?
Well, it's hard to tell. Let me tell you why, Chris, because there's so much secrecy involved. We really don't know. We just simply don't know. I wouldn't have known how serious the problem was had I not been involved within that circle of problems where they decide they're going to go after a certain person, and then until I got as deeply involved as I did, I didn't know that they were going around brutalizing people all over the place. Most other people don't know about that unless you're directly involved. And as I said, had there not been cell phones, we wouldn't have even known about the George Floyd incident. So I'm going to say it's probably not much better today than it's just the situation where we are now becoming aware that there is a problem. As a matter of fact, just last night, It's been all over the news. Something just happened. Something just got discovered in Louisiana, where they had shackled a person, a black man, and shackled him and dragged him, and he was begging for mercy, and he died. This was all over the news last night. So it seems to be going on, you know, on a nightly basis almost. So no, I don't think the problem's gotten any better. We're just a little bit more aware of the problem than we were before. They're still doing it, and there's still a fight going on. They're trying to get qualified immunity abolished, and the police departments are fighting that. The police unions are fighting it, and so that would be a good thing if they would abolish that. It just makes no sense. And they say, there's an old saying in our country where nobody is above the law. Well, that's a joke. Police are above the law because they have qualified immunity. And until that goes away, in other words, what that means is, unless you could absolutely prove that they knew they were violating the law when they were abusing you, when they were murdering you, when they were breaking your jaw while they were falsely arresting you, they're immune from liability. So, no, there's a lot of, I don't think the problem has gotten any better. We're just a little bit more aware of it now than we were before.
Brian Vukadinovich is an educator. He's a Northwest Indiana native. He's the author of a book entitled Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case. He's also written several op-eds on occasions on social justice and judicial fairness. And he's with us to talk about the issue of policing and police reform. And Brian, thank you for spending time with us today.
It's a very important topic, and I really appreciate you taking the time to get this information out to the public, because the public needs, you know, as we can see every night on a nightly basis, there's serious problems going on, and it's journalists like you that are very helpful hopefully getting some positive changes by letting the people know what's happening around the country with this problem. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A black woman in Indianapolis filed a complaint alleging housing discrimination after two low house appraisals spurred her to administer a fair housing test. She had a white friend stand in for her. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan filed a feature report for NPR's Morning Edition today.
Carla Duffy's tidy three-bedroom home close to downtown Indianapolis is in a historic black neighborhood. It's been completely renovated and sits across the street from a park in lush green space. She bought it 4 years ago for $100,000.
My house is my forever home. I love my neighborhood. I love my home.
With a hot housing market and low interest rates, Duffy wanted to refinance her mortgage to help fix up another home for her daughter. The first appraisal came back at $125,000, and she was shocked. A recent independent market analysis had estimated her home at $187,000, so she tried again.
And then to get the second one, and it's $15,000 lower, just a few months later. I just could not fathom, you know, there was this just nagging voice in my head that was saying that there is something wrong.
Duffy had a theory and wanted to put it to the test. When she applied for refinancing with a new lender, she left her race and gender off the application. One of her friend's husbands, who is white, agreed to stand in during the third appraisal. Before he did, she took out everything that might indicate her race and left her home. She got another shock when she got that appraisal back.
I scrolled so fast, and I was just like holding my breath, scrolling and getting to the bottom of it to see the number. I'm just like, I don't even want to read it just yet. I just want to see the number.
The number. $259,000, more than double the original appraisal.
And then it just sinks in. It just set in that what was devaluing my home was me.
Carlette Duffy filed a complaint against two of the lenders with HUD. Neither would comment for this story. But the appraiser with the lowest estimate, Tim Boston, stands by his report.
Anytime I put a report out, I prepare with the intention of having to defend that report before a group of my peers. It's all data-driven, so it's inherent in the data, and I wouldn't know how to change that.
A number of studies have found that black-owned homes are undervalued when compared to those of white homeowners. This is especially true in historically black neighborhoods. A study by the Brookings Institution finds that adds up to $156 billion in cumulative losses for black homeowners. Amy Nelson heads the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana and says local and federal policies that perpetuated racial segregation in the early 20th century play into the continued disparity.
It was the appraisal industry at the time that supported the very redlining maps that redlined Carlette's neighborhood and so many Black neighborhoods in our city.
Nelson says while it's hard to determine how prevalent the problem is, examples of racial bias and discrimination in the appraisal process have been discussed for years.
Just a growing number of Blacks and African Americans saying something's wrong here.
There also may be a growing desire to address this issue. HUD recently decided in favor of a complaint in a similar appraisal discrimination case. In a written statement, the American Society of Appraisers says it supports a focus on why Black homes are devalued. It adds that more education for appraisers and a more diverse workforce could be part of the solution. For NPR News, I'm Jill Sheridan.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.